last week we got off on a little tangent, and we were speaking about the Abarbanel's more esoteric pshat in this Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Yehi beischa beisvad lechachomim, you should make your home a place, a meeting place of the wise. They have a misabek ba'afa raglehem, and the simple meaning is sit at the dust of their feet, and they have a shosa b'tzama et divrehem. So he said that the Abarbanel, after he gives his simple explanation of this Mishnah, he says that your house means your mind. Make your mind a place, a meeting place of the wise, meaning don't always assume that your preconceived notions are right. Let your mind be open to the opinions of other people. Your mind should be a meeting place of many ideas and opinions. And be humble in accepting other people's ideas when they're right and you're wrong. And have a shosa b'tzoma estivrehem. And he says, drink with thirst, meaning don't drink too much, too fast, because you'll choke. So drink as a person who's thirsty drinks, but he drinks with wisdom to know the rate at which he can drink and not choke on what he's drinking. So last week, we started to speak about this idea that a person, even though he should always want to increase his knowledge and improve, constantly get better, especially when it comes to spiritual things. And we said, and that's what we got off on a tangent last time, we said that one of the ways of doing that is to be around great people, or if you can't be around them, at least to read about them, to learn about them, so they can be an incentive for you to grow and to have something to aspire towards. And then we spoke about the fact that learning and reading about the lives of great people, men and women, great people, is only valuable if you look at those great people as human beings who achieved tremendous amounts and made themselves into angels. But if you look at those people as superhuman beings, as angels themselves, who don't have any trials and tribulations, no yetzer hara, never had to make any choices, never had any failings, but were perfect from the time they were born, then you can't learn anything from them. You can be entertained by that, but nothing practical will ever come from it, because these people are different than me. I'm not perfect. I wasn't born a genius. I wasn't born a perfect saint, and therefore, I have a yetzer hara, and I have trials and tribulations that these people never had. So they're entertaining to look and see what kind of people there are, but it's like learning about angels. Right? I can't aspire to be Raphael or Michael or Gabriel. And therefore, it's important to learn and to read those kinds of biographies of Gedolim that at the same time point out their greatness, point out the fact that they made themselves great, that they had a struggle to make themselves great, and they had to work on it, just as much as anybody else has to work on it too. Okay, that was really not the intent of what I wanted to speak about this Mishnah. That was only the preface. Okay, now that you have this idea of aspiring towards great people, I remember that when I was a teenager, I read the biography of the Chafetz Chaim by Rabbi Yosher. It was translated from the Yiddish. It was very inspiring. I remember that for a week I didn't speak Lashon Hara. And I imagine that one day I was going to be the Chafetz Chaim. It was a very inspiring book. However, there is a caveat to all of that. And that is the following. That's what the Abarbanel says. Don't drink so much that you choke. Meaning that you should aspire to greatness, but you should achieve that greatness at a pace that you can keep up and not try to jump up a flight of stairs to reach the top, because usually what happens is you fall back and break your neck. This idea is brought out in a few different places. One, a maisa about the Chafetz Chaim. They say the Chafetz Chaim used to come into the Beis Medrash in Radin and turn out the lights or close the lights, whatever the what kind of lights they had there, put out the lights at 12 o'clock midnight and force his students to go to sleep. So they protested loudly. What kind of young, red-blooded Talmud Chacham goes to sleep at 12 o'clock? We want to sit here and learn until 2, 3 in the morning. Right? They said that, you know, what's it going to look like later on when Art School writes our biography and it says we went to sleep at 12 o'clock when we were 17? Even though they can rewrite history too, but in any case, better to write what really happened than write what you would have liked to happen. So in any case, so the Chafetz Chaim said it's very nice, but that's a Yetzer Hara. They said, Yetzer Hara? What in the world is the Yetzer Hara going to gain if we learn another 3 hours tonight? Chafetz Chaim said like this. He said, how long can you keep up a regimen? You have to get up for davening in the morning at 7 o'clock. You go to sleep at 3 and get up at 7. So if you don't get up at 7, we already know what the Yetzer Hara gained. Let's say you do get up at 7. How long can you keep up a schedule like that? 4 hours sleep a night. A week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Eventually you're going to fall off your feet from exhaustion and you're going to be in bed for a month and not going to be able to learn a word. The Yetzer Hara, the Satan, is a very, very shrewd businessman. He's willing to make an investment now for a larger profit later. So he's willing to invest a few hours a night that you'll learn extra, that after a month you won't learn for a whole month. You know, you figure out how many hours are wasted from learning Torah because of that, and how many are gained, and you'll see that the Satan comes out the winner. And he said, even if that doesn't happen, you can keep up a schedule of 4 hours sleep a night, it's going to take years off your life. Because later on, when you get older, because you didn't sleep properly when you were a youngster, you're going to lose years of your life. So the Satan has patience. He'll wait till then. And then you won't have all those years of learning. So you'll gain a few extra hours now, but you'll lose, in the long run, days, months, years of your life. He said, that's what we say in davening every night. The Hoser Satan milfaneinu umeachareinu. Take the Satan. The Satan is an obstacle. Take the Satan away from us, from in front of us and from behind us. He said, I understand how you can have an obstacle in front of you. You want to do something, and the Satan stands in front of you and tries to prevent you from doing it. But how can there be a Satan behind you? If you already passed the Satan, where's the obstacle? He says what it means, there are other explanations, but he says what it means is the following. Sometimes a person wants to do a mitzvah, and they want it so badly, and they are so determined that the Satan sees that there's no way to stop them. That if he stands in front of them, they'll steamroll him over. A woman wants to do chesed. She gets this bug. She wants to be involved in chesed. And it is so strong, her determination, that the Satan sees a waste of time to try to stop her. Do you know what he does? He runs behind her and he pushes. And he says, okay, you want to do chesed? Chesed in the morning, chesed in the afternoon, chesed at night. Don't see your husband, don't see your children, don't eat, don't sleep. Chesed. How long can she keep that up before she burns out? A week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? After that, she won't want to see chesed for another 3 years. So who gains in the end? The Satan. So sometimes the Satan is behind you, pushing, that you do more than you're capable of doing, in thinking that you are now improving, but you're drinking in such a way, like the Abarbanel says, that you're choking on it. Don't drink so much that you choke. drink enough that it will be beneficial to you slowly. And the truth is that that lesson doesn't only apply to ourselves, it applies very much how we deal with other people. Recently they sent me one of these advice line questions from Mishpacha magazine to answer. Every once in a while they decide that they want me to tell them what I think about a certain issue. And this one was a woman who, her husband works hard, works 7-8 hours a day, and he has a chavrusa in the morning before he goes to work, gets up early to an early dat minyan and goes and learns in the, early in the morning. At night, he has 2 hours before he conks out to go to sleep, and he has a chavrusa at night too. But she said some of the time at night, he just sits there and, what's it called, plays with a computer and, what's it called, relaxes. And she would like him to learn more and, you know, to be more involved in learning. And what should she do? Should she just give up and daven? Should she push him or whatever? So what I answered hasn't yet come out in the magazine, so I don't know if they're going to print it or not. What I answered her is the following. I said, on the one hand, people have to want to constantly grow and improve in spiritual matters. Okay. On the other hand, people have to know what their level is and at what pace they can improve. I said, Lamais, it sounds like your husband has a pretty busy schedule. He works 8 hours a day. And he deserves a little time of relaxation. You're going to push him to learn every extra hour, every extra second that he has, right? That may be good for the Vilna Gaon, but your husband doesn't have the schedule that the Vilna Gaon had. He's not the Vilna Gaon either. I said that really, not knowing who your husband is, right, and what the circumstances are, it's hard to give advice. But in general, right, you can't expect from a person more than they can produce. You can give them the incentive to want to grow, but you can't push them to something they can't do. And it sounds to me like your husband has a nice full day, and true, if he would be, you know, maybe on a higher madrega, he would use every moment, the spare moment he has to have his face in a safer, but maybe he's not holding by that. And the Rabbon Shalom doesn't function like that either. And I learned this from two places. First place, Torah says like this, Ma'at ma'at agoreisha to'amim ho'ela mipanecha. God tells the Jewish people, we're going to destroy the 7 nations that occupy the land of Canaan slowly. Why? Lo sucha lechalosa maher, because we can't destroy them quickly. Pentirbe olecha chayes asodeh. So Rashi explains what's going to happen is the following. If you destroy these people too quickly, you're not going to be able to occupy the land that you destroy the people from and is desolate, as fast as you destroy them. It's easier to destroy something than to inhabit it. So the land's going to remain desolate. And we know that in a desolate land, animals, wild animals come, and you're going to have trouble with the wild animals. So therefore, we'll destroy them slowly. Think about it for a second. So Rashi says, but the Jewish people have a promise that when they do God's will, they don't have to be afraid of wild animals. So what's the problem? Destroy them quickly, and the land will be desolate, but there'll be wild animals, but you don't have to worry about the wild animals because you'll be doing God's will. Says Rashi, Golui v'yadua lefanav, God knew that we wouldn't be doing his will all the time. And we'd have to worry about wild animals. Now think about it for a second. God's plan A, I'm sure, was to get rid of these Rishoyim, these evil, wicked people of Canaan, as fast as possible. They were the scourge of society. These were not just not nice people, you know, who didn't give a lot of tzedakah or whatever. They were really, really rotten people. Just to give you an idea of what that means, what these people were like, the Canaanim. They used to sacrifice their children to their gods. Okay, so, you know, they took a kid and they shechted him or whatever, thinking they would get success. No, that's not what they did. They took the kid and they passed him over a fire to a priest of their idolatry slowly. They passed him back and forth and back and roasted him slowly over the fire, okay? You have to be really, really a bad person to be able to do that to your own child, okay? I mean, some people would like to kill their children daily, right? But not like that, right? No matter how bad the kid is, you're not going to do that to your child. But they did that. On the other end of life, they did similar things. They had parents, old parents, who were a bother, right? So they didn't just, you know, ignore them, not visit them, right? They threw them to the dogs, literally. They said, you know, our dogs need a meal. We could save a meal if we feed our parents to the dogs, and it will kill two birds with one stone. And that's what they did. They used to feed their old parents to their dogs to save themselves a meal and to get rid of their parents. These were not nice people, okay, to say the least. So God had a vested interest in ridding the world of these evil people. So he gave us a mitzvah to destroy them, men, women, and children, because they are the personification of evil. Now, God's plan, I'm sure, was to get rid of them as fast as possible. And if we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, doing God's will, there's no problem in that. Because even though the land will be desolate for a while, we don't have to worry about wild animals because we're protected because we're doing God's will. Now God sees that we are not going to do his will. So he has two choices. He can say, you know, to heck with you. My plan is great if you be doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, so suffer. So you will be worried about wild animals. It's not my problem. Let's get rid of these people as fast as possible. The land will be desolate. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're going to have to worry about wild animals. Fine, so worry about wild animals. It's your fault. But God doesn't do that. He accommodates his plan and changes it to accommodate it to our lower level. I always tell teachers the following. Imagine if you're a fourth grade teacher. You just became a fourth grade teacher, never taught before. You spent an entire summer preparing a lesson plan for your fourth grade class. You investigated what a third grade class learns, what they're supposed to learn in fourth grade, and you spent hours and hours preparing a lesson plan. First day of school comes and you find out that these kids haven't learned anything last year. They tied up the teacher, locked her in a closet, and that was the end of the year. And they are brats who haven't learned a word, and they're still on beginning of third year level, and your lesson plan is way above their head. Now, you have two choices. You can say, well, if they would have done what they were supposed to do, my lesson plan would be perfect. I'm not changing my plan to accommodate their shortcoming. So, tough luck on them. I'm going to give them a plan that's way above their head. Tough luck on them. So they won't understand what's going on. It's not my fault. Or she can say, look, this is the fact. I have to reestablish my plan to fit their shortcomings. How does God function? The second way, not the first way. Okay. So a person has to know what their abilities and capabilities are, and even if they are not what they should be, they have to accommodate their behavior accordingly, and also what you expect of other people. Right. Another example. You see your little nine-year-old, okay, and in your mind, this nine-year-old someday is going to be the next Chazon Ish, the next Vilna Gaon. Right? This child is blessed with talents, abilities, capabilities, a pure neshama. You see this child really developing into the next Gadol B'Yisrael, okay? And you have your hopes that you're going to be the mother of this Gadol, right? That someday they're going to put you in one of those art scroll books as his mother. Okay. In any case, and you fell over this child and you daven by lift benching, you know, that you should see your little Gadol grow into a big Gadol. And then one day you see this little child riding his bicycle. And you yell at him, what are you doing riding a bicycle? The Vilna Gaon doesn't ride bicycles. Get in the house, put your feet in ice water and learn for the next 24 hours. You're going to destroy that child. Yeah, you have expectations of him one day being the Vilna Gaon, but right now he's a 9-year-old who needs to ride his bicycle. So you can't demand of him to function according to your expectations, but only according to the reality of the situation. You have to give him the incentive to want to grow, but you can't demand of him what you imagine he will be like when he's grown. Even worse than that, you know, that situation, you know, is nice, cute. But I see this all the time by seminary girls. Right? They, you know, look up to this teacher or that teacher who are 50, 60, 70 years old and have worked on themselves for years and have reached a level of being an established Ben Torah, Talmud Chacham, or whatever. And then when they go on Shiduchim, they're looking for boys who are exactly like the teachers or the examples that they've been given. Okay, now I guarantee you, none of these great people were like that when they were 19 or 20. It was a lifetime of reaching like that. But they don't understand that. So they look at all these young guys and they don't find anybody that fits their image of the kind of person they want to marry. The kind of person you want to marry, somebody when he's 60, 70, is going to be like these people. But not that he's like them now, because they weren't like that now. And if you want to go marry a 60, 70-year-old, we don't advise it. Right? So sometimes you... And then the worst part is, okay, so then it only affects them. So if they can't find the shidduch, because they can't find anybody who's 20 years old and is as if they're 70. That's l'chavotzar. The problem is when they do get married, and then they expect from their husbands what you can expect from Rav Shach, but they're not Rav Shach yet. And Rav Shach wasn't Rav Shach either when he was 19 years old. And then they make their husbands' lives miserable. So, and make sure that they'll never be Rav Shach, because they're this advice line question, right? So, what I told this woman was that...
Maybe she should ask her husband, instead of doing that, to realize they should spend time with her to develop their shalom bayit better.
Yeah, maybe. What I told her was, look, she has to balance giving him incentive in a very positive way of wanting to grow, at the same time recognizing where he's holding. And third thing, even though a person has to want to grow, they have to be happy with where they are also. They can't be satisfied with it. They have to be happy with it. The Vilna Gaon says on the Pasuk in Mishlei, Lev Chacham Liamino, Velev Ksil Lishmolo. A wise person's heart is to the right, and a foolish person's heart is to the left. Says the Vilna Gaon, when you're learning a Sefer in Hebrew, what you've learned already is to your right. What you've yet to learn is to the left. A foolish person only looks at what he hasn't accomplished, and he gives up. And he says, there's so much to learn, I'll never do it. So he forget about it. The wise person also wants to learn more. But every once in a while, he looks to the right to see what he's accomplished. And it gives him a chizuk. It strengthens him and gives him the ability then to want to continue on. You have to be happy with where you are, not satisfied with it, and want more. That's the way. But if you ignore completely what you've accomplished, then you just get frustrated. You're always looking at what you don't have and where you're not, then it's frustrating. So I told her that she has to balance all these things out and daven very good that she'd be successful, and then she'll see success with herself and her family, whatever, in any case. So so that's also, a person has to know how to give encouragement. At the same time, to be happy, I said you should be happy with where your husband's holding to. You know, there's plenty of husbands who work 8 hours a day, don't learn a word. They don't get up early in the morning to have a chavrusa, and they don't have a chavrusa at night when they have 2 hours. So your husband's not holding yet by the ideal. But appreciate where he's holding. And give him gentle encouragement to want to improve according to what he's capable of doing. Okay, in any case.
Why she doesn't complain? He didn't have time for me.
Maybe she doesn't like him, I don't know. In any case, maybe he does have time for her, I don't know. Maybe she plays the computer games with him, I don't know. That's why I said I never have enough information to really give advice. In any case, so there's another place where we see this idea, that at the same time that you have to want and aspire towards greater things, and for yourself and for those around you. At the same time, you have to deal with things as they are, not according to what your expectations are. Another place we see this is the following. Torah says, before Shemitah, people are told, you can't plow, plant, harvest regularly. The food's not yours. It's hefker for anybody, even if things grow by themselves on the trees. So you're going to ask, what are we going to eat in the third year? We didn't plant, we didn't plow, we didn't able to harvest. What are we going to eat? So God said, I will give you a bracha in the sixth year, and it'll produce enough food for 3 years. So you'll have it already there, you won't have any problems. The Mefarshim asked, what if you don't ask? That's if you ask, what are we going to eat? What if you have total belief in God and trust, and you don't ask any questions? Then what happens? Says the Sfarno, then you'll get a bigger bracha. You won't need 3 years of food, but you'll get 1 year of food, but it'll last for 3 years. That's a bigger bracha. You'll eat a little bit, and you'll be satisfied with it. That's a bigger bracha than having 3 years of food. The question is, why is that a big bracha? So some say because you have less work to do. If you have 3 years of food, you have to harvest it. It's a lot of work. This way, you only have to harvest 1 year. And the others say that if you have a bumper crop in the sixth year, it's going to bother you even more that you have to keep Shemitah because you think you're losing 3 years of crops. You don't realize that that's a special bracha that you wouldn't have had without the special bracha. In any case, I was thinking of an idea why that is a bigger bracha. Whatever the reason is, a bigger bracha not to have to whatever to have. To have 1 year to the last 3 years instead of having 3 years worth of crop. I think the idea is the following. A person who has emunah and bitachon, 1 year's crop is not going to bother them. They'll have emunah and bitachon that's going to last, and it will last. But a person who doesn't have emunah and bitachon is asking questions. What am I going to eat? So if I only give you 1 year's crop, and it lasts for 3 years, every day you're going to be worried, what's going to be tomorrow? Is this going to last? Is this going to last? So the Rabban Hashem gives you 3 years, you have it in your storehouse, and you don't have to worry. Meaning, really I could give you 1 year, and I'd prefer to do that, and if you have emunah and bitachon, it'll be perfect. You'll believe that it's going to last for 3 years. But if you don't have that belief, if I give you 1 year, you're going to be fretting every day what's going to be. So I'm going to accommodate your low madrega and give you 3 years worth of crop so you don't have any problems. You see it in the storehouse, you can rely on it. So we see here also that God deals with us according to our lower level, even though he would rather deal with us according to his expectations and not have to give us 3 years of crop. But if he realizes that's where we're holding, then that's what he gives us to accommodate the reality of where we're holding. That's the idea. And therefore, that's what the Abadanel says, to have a shosa, but you should look up to these gedolim and want to be like them. And you should have a tremendous amount of aspiration and desire to improve and grow. On the other hand, you shouldn't drink too fast. Drink, don't choke. Aspire, but do it at the level that you can do it. Don't jump up a flight of stairs. Go one step at a time. Then you'll be successful. Yes?
Would this faith and the secret apply as well to the man where they didn't see the food coming up until the next day?
Yeah, there it says... There it was. God said, I tested you for 40 years to teach you the fact that you should have emunah and bitachon. If every day for 40 years... They knew they didn't have the food in the cupboard. They woke up in the morning and it was there. But they had to have emunah and bitachon that the man would fall. Then for 40 years, the Jewish people learned it was a learning experience for the rest of Jewish history of how to deal with emunah and bitachon and a million other things. Okay. Okay. Next. So that finishes the explanations of the Abarbanel. And now we will give you a taste of some of the other commentaries on this Mishnah. Rabbeinu Yonah says, what does it mean, make your house a meeting place of the wise? Okay. He says that you should publicize that your house is open for meetings, for learning, or whatever. And one of the ways of doing that is not just to put up signs, but to make your home the kind of home that great people and righteous people would feel comfortable in. But if your home isn't the kind of home that they would feel comfortable being in, then you can put up all the signs in the world, they're not going to meet in your house. But if they know that you make your house a place that is fit to be a meeting place for the wise, then eventually they'll gravitate to that kind of home. Okay, so that's the Rabbeinu Yonah. The Mevar Tanura says that having misabek ba'ofar raglehem. What does that mean, misabek? So the word avak means dust. So one meaning could be, says the Rav, when you walk behind somebody, they kick up dust, and then it's a euphemism for following somebody. Walk in their dust, meaning follow them. Okay, 1 second, I'll tell you why that euphemism is used. But that's what the Rav says. He says what it really means is follow their ways. Make your house a place where you can come in contact with great people and wise people, and then follow them. Walk behind them, so you walk in their dust and drink their words, what's it called, thirstily. Okay. Thinking, why does it use that euphemism? Why don't you say, v'holech achareihem, learn from them, follow them. Why does it say walk in their dust? I was thinking, perhaps, sometimes people who follow Das Torah, who listen to Gedolei Yisrael, get dust all over them. Meaning, people don't understand many times what Gedolim... A Gadol sees things a lot different than the average person. He sees the Ezeu Chacham HaRoes HaNolad. He sees the implications, far-reaching effects of any situation. And therefore he deals with it not according to how it appears now, but how it appears maybe in the long run. I think the Velvel Brisker said about his father, he said, my father could see 100 years into the future what the implications
the
consequences of anything that he had to decide and make a decision about how to react to something or whatever. He said, I can see 50 years maybe ahead, but my father could see 100 years ahead. What were the implications or whatever? And sometimes because of that, people don't understand. You know, Gedolim make a big deal about something, and people understand, what's the big deal? Right? What's the big deal? So it's all so terrible. Why do they have to make such a big thing? And it causes strife and argument or whatever. And so first of all, you have to realize that if you have questions like that on Gedolei Yisrael, then think to yourself, now, don't you think these people are smart enough to know what you know? That what is this worth? That it's going to get this and this reaction and that reaction because this machlokas, that machlokas. Right? Do you think that they don't know that? They don't know as much as you know? You know more than them? That's obviously not the case. So they do know. And still they say it's kedai to make this tumult, because obviously they think that it's worth it. So then have emunas chachamim that they know what they're doing. That maybe you're not aware of the implications and consequences, and they are. Or maybe they're aware of more information than you have. I'll give you an example. I can't think of an example that's not controversial, so we'll give one that's controversial. Rav Shach, right, opposed Lubavitch. Way back in the 1960s, when all they were doing was the Hasidim were saying that the Rebbe is Mashiach, and the Rebbe himself, there was once a Time magazine interview with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and they asked him this question. They asked him, do you realize that a personality cult has grown around you and people are saying that you're the Messiah? He said, that's ridiculous. He said, so they said to him, then why don't you say something? So he said, I try to minimize it, but whatever I'll do won't help. Because if I tell them that I'm not Mashiach, you know, they're going to say I'm just humble. Right? They're not going to believe me anyway, so it's not going to help. That was Lubavitcher Rebbe himself. Okay. But the Chassidim and certain Gedolei Yisrael, Rav Shach amongst them, right, made a milchemes mitzvah against this. And many people, even big people, said, what's the big deal? They're not, what are they doing so terrible or whatever? So, you know, every chassid thinks his Rebbe could be Mashiach or whatever, and what's the big deal? After the Lubavitcher Rebbe got a stroke, it already became evident why Rav Shach, his opposition. Because then they had an ability to use him in a way that he couldn't react. And then they crowned him as Mashiach, took advantage of his situation. He pushed it, was not too much in this world. He was already after, they used him like a puppet, some of them. Some of them were against it, but they couldn't say anything. It was, and then when he died, according to some people, they wouldn't accept the fact that he's dead. They were mishugoyim by the funeral that were dancing and singing, and they were not anti-Lubavitch. They were Lubavitchers who just said the Rebbe didn't die. Finished. He's still alive. And they still, till this day, he's Mashiach, he's coming back, which puts him in the same category as some other person who thought he was Mashiach and was coming back. It's a different religion. So, again, the eye at the time, what was the big deal? The truth is that because Rav Shach made such a protest at the time, made such a big deal, there were many Lubavitcher Hasidim who had to feel that they had to answer this, you know, and say that it's not true. And because of that, there's a good portion of Lubavitch that didn't go crazy afterwards. Because in order to be able to show that they were, you know, that this is not what Rav Shach said is not true. They don't think the Rebbe's Mashiach, and they don't think that he's God or whatever, and that's not an exaggeration. I saw in print from some of these crazy people that they consider Lubavitcher Rebbe God's incarnate. He is God in this world in human form, which is even worse. That's Mamish Christianity. Mamish Christianity. But these are the fringe Mishugoyim. But there's a lot more than the fringe Mishugoyim who consider him Mashiach, consider he's coming back, or whatever. But there is a hardcore of Lubavitchers that don't accept any of this. They aren't outspoken because it's not so easy to go against the tide. But I give Rav Shach credit that at least Lubavitch survived this because of the opposition. They say the same thing happened to Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon's opposition to Hasidus kept Hasidus within the parameters of Judaism. If he wouldn't have, protested what he did, then it would have gone completely off the derech, early Hasidus. In fact, I saw once Rav Kook, Zatzal, said that if there wasn't somebody like Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld screaming and protesting the things that he had to protest, then I'd have to do it. Somebody has to do it, because otherwise things get out of hand completely. So sometimes you don't realize that. We don't see. We see what's in front of us. And therefore, a lot of people at times on Rav Shach, even big people. What's he making such a big deal? But now looking back, you know, 50 years later, Taka, you could see that it was Kedai to make a big deal. Had he not made a big deal, then who knows where Lubavitch would be today. All of them. And it would have been even worse than the fringe or whatever or minority of the people that have gone completely off the wall. In any case, so therefore, but somebody who therefore follows Das Torah and follows these people get dust on them. People look at them and say, you know, what are you doing? These people, you know, they're not worth following or whatever. You don't know what you're doing. And also, there's another thing that happens when you get walk behind somebody and they kick up dust. Gets in your eyes and you can't see. When you follow a godel, you should follow him blindly. If you know the person's a godel, he's worth following, then even if you're going to get dirty and people are going to say, you know, what are you following this person? He doesn't know what he's doing or whatever. But I know that he's an Adam godel, right? And he's the you know, how do you know if this person's a godel? How do Anoshim Gedolim look at him? How do you know if a doctor is really a special doctor? Not necessarily from what the Hamonam, what the patients say, right? But what do other doctors say? What do the professors say? All the professors say, this guy is somebody special. You know, he's somebody special. So look at all the Talmidei Chacham and see who they look up to as Anoshim Gedolim. And if you know for sure the person's an Adam Gadol, then be willing to get sullied by following him, even if people are going to make fun of you because they don't understand what he says and therefore they understand why you're following him. And even if it means blinding your eyes and not questioning, but accepting the fact that if I accept this person, then I have to have trust that he knows what he's doing. So that could be by the euphemism of having misabit ba'afar aglehem. Both of those things need qualification, like everything. Nothing is black and white. Right? Sometimes you can't follow somebody blindly, right? And sometimes you have to be consider what they... But then what you should do is go to the godel and speak to him. Tell him what you think and see what his reaction is. That's okay to do. We'll see next week, another pshat in this misabek ba'afar raglehem. The heavy shosa, the tzoma, divrehem, also lends itself to understand when you're allowed to argue with an Adam Gadol. Do you have to blindly accept everything he says, or can you argue with him? That we'll see in Mitzvah Shem next week.